ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
More and more Australians are turning to weight loss drugs, the so-called GLP-1 medications, with brand names like Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, Zepbound. So we thought it was time for an update on what we know about them and their effects and possible side effects. Last week, Australia's Therapeutic Drugs Administration issued a safety warning about potential risks of suicidal thoughts or behaviours. Then last week, the World Health Organization issued its first guidelines for the use of these drugs to treat obesity. So where is the science at, and what more do we know about how they impact us long term, and who should be using them, and are they just a short term fix, or could we be safely on them long term? If you've got questions, 1-300-800-222 or text 0467-922-702. Dr. Terry Lynn South is my guest, a GP and accredited practicing dietitian, chair of the Royal Australian College of GPs Specific Interest Group in Obesity Management. Dr. South has been has had over 25 years clinical experience, 15 of it in general practice, and since 2021 has been focusing full-time on obesity and metabolic health as medical director of Lifestyle Metabolic in Brisbane. She leads a clinic there and promotes evidence-based holistic care and promotes equitable access to obesity medications and reducing treatment stigmas too. Terry Lynn, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a refresher. These GLP-1 drugs, this is the class of drugs, isn't it? I read out a few of the brand names earlier. How do they work to help people lose weight?
Well, they are basically mimicking a natural hormone that our gut produces when we eat. It's called a GLP, which stands for glucagon-like peptide. Now, that natural hormone that's released in our intestine that works all throughout the body, that has a role in hunger, satiety, insulin secretion, that only lasts a few minutes. And these medication versions of that last hours and days and potentially weeks. So it's a drug version of a natural occurring hormone.
Right.
And it was initially used to treat type 2 diabetes because of its effect on insulin as well as blood glucoses.
Right.
And I remember the first one of these GLP-1 medications came in, gosh, it must be 10, 15 years ago. And it was a twice a day injection, and then it became a one a day injection. It was called exenatide, brand name Byetta Bydureon. And I'd be using that in my patients with type 2 diabetes. And they had tried all of the diet and lifestyle. They'd gone through a number of oral medications. And the next step in order to help from controlling a diabetes point of view, meeting those blood glucose targets, was a needle, which was called insulin. And a lot of my patients didn't want to go on insulin. It was a needle. It was associated with weight gain. But this new class of medication, the GLP-1s, known as incretin therapy, came on. And I remember talking about the pros and cons and side effects of this new GLP-1 medication. And one of the side effects of these very first generation GLP-1s was weight loss. It wasn't particularly large amount of weight loss, but I remember specifically talking about that. And here since then, we've had these newer generations of these classes of medications where that side effect of weight loss has actually been promoted. And now the tables have turned where we have very high potent, you know, third and fourth generation GLP-1s where they're now called obesity management medications.
Right. I mean, someone was saying to me the other day, oh, the new ones are better. They're all in tide, don't they? There's some.
That's right.
Semaglutide, tirzepatide, and so on and so forth. Are the more recent ones more effective?
Yes, they are. Depending on which you ask me, you know, on what basis are we talking effectiveness? But if we're talking about weight loss, yes, the more third and fourth generation GLP-1s are more effective, and also in blood glucose control, they are more effective as well. That's correct.
Mm. Yeah, so they were first developed as you know, drugs for other things. Did drug companies discover that they were good for obesity and other things too? Because I mean, they're apparently good for other conditions as well. Did they discover this after people started using them, or how
yes,
did they come?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So again, the first sort of indication of the tides was for type 2 diabetes, and yes, weight loss was a side effect. And then they looked at the different types of molecules in that family of GLP-1 class of medications, manipulating the molecules to get more of what they wanted, both in regards to obesity, weight loss, but also they noticed in the trials that people would be coming back from having their check-ins regularly during these seminal trials, and they would mention things like they noticed that their alcohol desires had reduced. And I think we will see in the future that another indication of these medications will be on what we have observed. And certainly there are some trials looking at these GLP-1 medications in reducing alcohol addiction and dependence.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? I want to get to that in a moment, because doctors I've spoken to, on the side about this, have all been quite glowing about them, saying, well, yeah, no, they're great, particularly for the cardiovascular system, also maybe brain health benefits as well.
Yeah, that's right. These medications have what we call a pleiotropic effect, which means that they work in many different areas of the body. And that's because the different areas of the body have receptors for this hormone, which is really interesting to think that it's, secreted in the gut, but it's also acting in the brain, in the heart, in the kidneys, and just as a few examples. And I do think that we're just looking at the very tip of what this medication may be able to do from a health point of view. That's right.
Mm. Marjorie from Pinjarra has just texted in saying, I've been on Mounjaro now for 5 weeks. I've lost 6 kilograms. At 56, I've spent my life as an emotional eater and eating disorders in the age of 11. For 5 weeks now, I've had no food noise. I don't eat for the sake of eating. I don't think about food. I don't spend money at the supermarket on unnecessary food. I used to eat all the time. For me, it's a life changer. I suspect my next blood test will be positive because of it, but I feel great. This appears to be a common story. Is it, Terry Lynn?
Yeah, yes, it is. I think that in general, people who are using the medication from a weight loss desire will find I talk about how it works in four different ways. There should be a reduction in appetite. You're not as hungry as what you used to be. Feel full with less food. Mm-hmm. Feel full for longer. And for some people, not all people, they may notice that their desires for certain foods are not as much as they used to be. Certainly, high calorie foods, and we've mentioned about the alcohol before, they just don't feel like it anymore.
Mm. Most drugs come with side effects. There must be some. What are they?
I would say that all drugs come with side effects.
Actually, that's right. I'll revise my sentence. All drugs come with side effects. What are the side effects with this ones? With these?
Yeah, I think a lot of people know about some of what I'd call the early side effects. So in general, that's what we'd call the gastrointestinal side effects. So initially, there may be some nausea, relatively common, should be mild and should definitely get better and eventually peter out. For some people, that nausea is so severe, they may get some vomiting. Mm-hmm. It can also slow down the movement of food, both from the stomach but also through the intestines, and so there can be an increased risk of constipation. Mm-hmm. I find that doesn't necessarily get better. In fact, it gets worse because people eat less. Paradoxically, for the same drug, we can also see diarrhea mentioned as a side effect. In my experience, that's less of a issue in the real world as what they saw in the trials. But later side effects, I think we're really starting to be more mindful about now, which includes what I'd say is nutritional quality. So if people are eating significantly less food, we need to make sure they still get in their nutrients. And particularly if people are losing weight, we don't want to actually make their weight, their health worse if they are losing significant amounts of muscle.
Mm. All right. Annie from Port Macquarie. Hello, Annie.
Hello.
Hello. What's your what's your question?
I'm curious. I am obese. I have type 2 diabetes and I have raised liver function, but my doctor for the last 2 years has denied me subscription to one of these drugs. So I'm just wondering why that might be.
I don't know. Terry Lynn?
Yeah, I'm not too sure.
We can't obviously. Annie. I mean, it's a bit hard, Annie, in the circumstances with,
of course,
without Terry Lynn having a chance to examine you. But Terry Lynn, are there some in a broader sense? Could you talk to her about?
Yeah, I can. So there are very limited what we'd call absolute contraindications of these medications, but if you have had a personal or family history of a particular type of thyroid cancer called medullary thyroid cancer or a family history, that's an absolute contraindication.
And I don't. Yep.
Yep. Another one would be in regards to are you also taking similar sorts of medication, so you can't double up on them? So I'm not sure if you're on...
I forgot to mention I have psoriatic arthritis.
Okay, yep.
Again, so that would... I inject Humira every fortnight. I'm on prednisone, etc. Yeah.
So in general, there aren't too many medications that that interfere, so that wouldn't be an issue. Okay. If you'd already on, dulaglutide or another similar medication, you wouldn't double up on them. But I do think that there may be something that your GP knows with regards to potential, pros and cons of these medications. So it's definitely a very individual decision. But I'd be asking your GP where they're coming from as to why they wouldn't. I think that people need to understand, and this is, it's a very individual decision as to whether this is going to be appropriate for the individual. One thing that I think that the audience needs to understand is that these medications are not a short thing. They're not a silver bullet. They are expected to be long term, and therefore, access and cost of that, because most of these medications are on private script and they are very expensive. And so I certainly have found some patients that are thinking that it's going to be a short-term thing. They're just going to get to their goals and don't understand that it is expected that people will need to be on them long-term. And I might suggest that their money is better spent elsewhere if it's not something that they can maintain long-term.
Mm. Okay.
I would be very happy to maintain it long-term. In fact, this is my GP of 20-odd years.
Mm.
And I'm considering moving to another GP.
Well, mate, that's always an option.
Refuses.
It's always an option, Annie, to get a second opinion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm, okay. All right. Thank you. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Terry Lynn South, Dr. Terry Lynn South is my guest, an expert in these. Well, I'm calling them weight loss drugs because that appears to be the main, the more common use of them these days. The World Health Organization has suggested they ought to be listed as weight loss drugs, even though they were developed, as you say, for diabetics. There have been, they're not listed as on the PBS here in Australia, as weight loss drugs. That if you prescribe them for diabetes in Australia, you're paying, I think, about $35 a month. If you're buying them for weight loss, you can't get them on the PBS, and you're paying $200 to $300 a month, aren't you?
Or even more, up to $600 a month. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Philip, can I just say something? Look, this is my personal bugbear, and I'm showing my bias here, but I prefer to use the term obesity management drugs because, obesity management is more than just weight loss and weight control. And certainly there will be some patients who don't actually lose weight on these medications. It can be extremely variable how people respond. But even if they don't lose weight, they can still get health benefits by having obesity management, whether it includes GLP-1s or not. And so I think that we need to understand that obesity is more than just weight loss, and we're talking about health gains for people who do have what we call clinical obesity.
Mm. The Therapeutic Goods Administration here has listed some mental health concerns and warnings about people taking these drugs. What's your take on that?
I'm not surprised that the TGA has come out with that warning. There has been a lot of argy-bargy about the mental health effects of these medications. And just to say that, obesity, like a lot of chronic conditions, has a very complex relationship with mental health.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about obesity having a bi-directional relationship with mental health, meaning that people whose mental health, have difficulties from a mental health point of view are more at risk of developing obesity, and people who have obesity are more at risk of developing mental health concerns. With regards to the role of these GLP-1 medications, there was the argy-bargy in that for some research studies, it suggested there was an improvement in mental health, but other research studies suggested that there was a worsening, but particularly around the potential for worsening suicidal thoughts. Mm. And so when there is such mixed research out there, you've got to wonder what's the true story. I think the true story is that there is going to be a subgroup, a population who's more at risk of potentially worsening depression and suicidal thoughts. But because suicidal thoughts that are worsening is potentially a lethal condition, it behoves the TGA to take a risk adverse approach and to educate both prescribers and the public about this potential risk.
Mm. It doesn't work for everyone, doesn't it? Does it? I've spoken to some people. This is anecdotally, of course, Terry Lynn, who said, "Look, I got some because I really wanted to. I've heard that it curtails a desire for alcohol, and I really want to do something about drinking," which some people have reported that it does, that, where once upon a time they were drinking to possibly unsafe levels, and they say after taking these drugs, their desire for large amounts of alcohol vanishes or goes away. Others report there's no such effect. What's your experience been?
My experience is that absolutely it's very individual how someone responds to this medication. We can talk about, averages, but I do find that it is extremely individual. Some people in the original trials of these medications actually gained weight.
Right.
And so that's where I think that, we see often the extremes of people's experiences on these medications on social media, the extremes positives or the extremes negatives. But the reality is, that bell-shaped curve. And yes, I do think that even though we're talking about, GLP-1s as a class of medication, the way that I like to describe it to my patients is, imagine that we're talking about citrus fruit. So the class of medication is like citrus fruit, but each individual drug, one's a lime, one's a lemon, one's a grapefruit. Okay. And so there can be nuances between the different medications and how they respond to certain things that you're trying to achieve. So I certainly have noticed a difference between semaglutide and tirzepatide with regards to alcohol reduction.
In what way?
I personally have found that semaglutide is more of an alcohol reduction of desire than the tirzepatide.
Okay.
And so this is where sometimes I think it can be absolutely very individual. So patients will have come to me and they'll say, "Oh no, I tried low dose semaglutide, otherwise known as Ozempic, and it didn't work for me." And what I will be saying is, well, it doesn't necessarily mean that a different GLP-1 won't work.
Mm.
And then I also ask, what does work mean to you? And so if someone said to me they didn't lose weight on 1 milligram semaglutide, otherwise known as Ozempic, I'd say, well, I'm not surprised, because 1 milligram semaglutide is not a weight loss obesity management dose.
Mm-hmm.
That is a dose that is most beneficial to blood glucose. The highest dose of semaglutide, known as Wegovy, is 2.4 milligrams. So you can't really compare 1 milligram effectiveness to 2.4 milligram effectiveness.
Right. And Mounjaro is the tirzepatide, is it? Is that the...
Yeah, that's right.
Right, okay.
And what's it?
Yeah, and you say that's less effective for our alcohol inhibitions.
That's been my personal experience.
Okay.
So I don't have any head-to-head trials or evidence to be able to roll that out. But certainly I found that, yes.
How do you choose between... what's the clinical decision between these two?
Look, to be honest, some of it is what is on the TGA indications at the moment. So, for example, with regards to Mounjaro, there is a TGA indication for people who have moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea and also a higher BMI, whereas with the Wegovy semaglutide 2.4, there is an indication for secondary reduction of what we call cardiovascular disease. So people who've already have diagnosed with cardiovascular disease, maybe they've had a cardiac event, and this reduces their risk of developing a second event. And it's not just to say that, and this seems to be above what we'd expect for any weight loss alone. So there is something else going on that the curves, what we call the placebo versus the active drug treatment in the trials, the mortality and morbidity in regards to cardiovascular disease, they separated out a lot earlier than what we would have predicted for weight loss alone. Mm. So we do think there are other things going on with regards to inflammation as well as, you know, secondary reduction in blood pressure, cholesterol, triglycerides, etc., etc.
All right. Dr. Terry Lynn South is my guest, an expert in these weight loss drugs, Mounjaro, Wegovy, Ozempic, and those things. If you've got questions, 1-300-800-222. Love to take them.
Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
What happens when you go off the drugs, Terry Lynn?
In general, there is a return of any of those metabolic markers. So, right.
So you've got to stay on them then.
Yes, you do, and the weight regain as well.
Okay, is there any negative to staying on them? Do we know what happens to people who are taking them long term?
We don't really know more than up to 4 years at the moment. Right. So these are still relatively new medications, particularly these newer generations. And that's why they're still under what we call the Black Triangle Monitoring Scheme. So we don't have long-term data. And I do think that, you know, it's I have cautious optimism about these medications. I must say that, you know, I've been around long enough to see wonder drugs come to market and then get pulled years down the track. And so, yeah, I am mindful that, you know, I don't want to overstate the positives. I think we need to be cautiously optimistic. It is very much down to an individual, right, you know, pros, cons side of.
Do you think they should be on the PBS for weight loss?
Yes, I do. Right. Yes, I do. Okay. And I've been part of the RACGP, you know, lobbying for that consideration. The PBAC, which is the committee that looks at PBS applications, did sit in November to consider mm-hmm. the GLP-1 class, and we're hoping to hear the verdict of that.
Would it be massively expensive if they were?
So this is where it comes down to a negotiation between the drug companies and, right, and the government. So we've got two players here. So, you know, I think both players need to you know, come to, you know, mutually beneficial arrangements where the health of our nation and even the cost of the health that goes with having obesity is reduced, but at the same time, the, you know, the drug companies need to ensure that we can afford it as a country,
yeah,
as well.
Course. That's right. But at this stage, it's fair to say, is it, that, I mean, this is, I don't want to cause anybody anxiety, that there's no known ill effect of staying on the drugs for an extended period.
We've had the lower dose semaglutide Ozempic in Australia since 2018, and we're still monitoring the potential long-term effects of that lower dose semaglutide Ozempic. And there are a list of things that I will go through with my patients about what is known, and I will talk about, you know, potential side effects. I'll say what's common, what's uncommon, what's rare, and then I'll have a list of things of, you know, potential, you know, negatives that we're watching, all right, that I can't tell you what the background rate is, or the background rate is changing. And then I'll also talk about potential positives as well, and all of these things are changing. So it is rapidly changing, and what I feel that I would talk about to people now may actually be different in 6 months' time. So I feel as though it's still, you know, as far as we know, there are significant risks, but when we're talking about things like, you know, pancreatitis, we're talking about, you know, 1 in 3,000, but it's different for different individuals. So if you have type 2 diabetes, that background risk of pancreatitis is actually higher.
That's right. This is what the advice has been coming, isn't it? Look, yes, there may well be long-term risks, because there are huge long-term risks in obesity.
That's right.
And you know, and the cardiovascular risks and so on. Ron from Anna Bay. G'day, Ron.
Hi, hello. How are you, my friend?
Very well. What's been your experience, Ron?
It's been nothing but a good experience. I've been on it for 6 months now, the Mounjaro. I started off on the 2.5 mil.
Right.
And after a month, I moved up to the 5, and I've been on it 6 months now. I was 142 kilos, and I'm now 114.
Wow. Okay. That's a life-changing amount of weight for you, I imagine, isn't it, Ron?
Well, it was. I was morbidly obese. That's why I got put on it. And yeah. I had a severe problem with alcohol. And I was in a clinic, and that's where it got recommended to me. I was in the clinic for alcohol.
Have you found the drug with your alcohol desires?
Well, I don't drink anymore.
Okay.
Stop me drinking.
Yeah.
I had a few beers on grand final night, and it tasted like petrol.
Yeah, well... So
it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
for nobody ever believed that I'd be able to give up drinking. People that know me, but I don't drink now.
Well, you're saving yourself a fortune, I presume, Ron, as well.
Yeah, well, the price of beer nowadays, $8 a schooner, I am saving myself a fortune.
Yeah. You're paying for this yourself, so it's expensive as a drug every month, but you presumably, on that basis, would be recouping it from not spending money on alcohol.
Yeah, well, luckily I'm a veteran, so I got subsidised by DVA, you know, because I got classified as morbidly obese and had a problem with the alcohol. So, I got subsidised. I don't pay the full amount, but luckily, but yeah, we've got my son on it now because he's a bit overweight. So I've recommended he get on it. He's loving it too.
On you, Ron. Thanks for sharing it with us. Appreciate it.
No worries, mate.
Yes, so these drugs, are they effective or not? Hi, everyone's different, says my text. I've been on Monjaro 2 months, was drinking four nights a week, but I've lost all appetite for alcohol and now I don't drink at all. Sebastian from Perth says, hi there, I'd like to take Ozempic for weight loss, but my GP won't prescribe it, not unless my BMI gets significantly higher. Should I simply go to another GP? Terry Lynn?
There are definitely rules from the TGA with regards to what are the criteria that allow that medication to be prescribed with approval, and BMI, body mass index, is one of them. I'm not a big fan of body mass index because I don't think it actually describes what we would call clinical obesity, but that is at the moment one of the TGA lines in the sand with regards to
It's not very kind to Pacific Islanders, BMI, is it?
No, that's exactly right, yeah. Mm. Yeah, but I think it shouldn't be, it has its role in regards to population and risk, but it shouldn't be the sole assessment in regards to something called clinical obesity.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Mary, there are spots on the board if you would like one. 1-300-800-222. My guest is Dr. Terry Lynn South, an expert on these weight loss drugs. If you're on the pen or considering going on it or seeking advice from your doctor, a chance to have your questions answered. Mary from Ringwood, hello.
Oh, hello. Thanks for answering my call. Doctor, you mentioned earlier about this when you go off the Wegovy, you tend to regain the weight. I was wondering if they've done any research on, if I'm on 2.4 milligrams, if I decided to stop it, if I wean myself down to the lower dose, would that have any impact? Is there any research on that by titrating it down to see if that makes a difference?
Mary, unfortunately, we don't have any evidence to tell us the effectiveness of that. Because these drugs are still very new, we've only got really good research about people who stay on the medication out to 4 years, have not experienced significant weight gain, and we've only got evidence that when patients do stop the medication within 12 months, they will regain two-thirds of what they had lost within the next 12 months, and their metabolic improvements go back. Yeah, that's right. But Mary, we don't have the data of, you know, is it possible to wean this medication? What would the weaning look like? Like, we don't have answers. I do think those studies are being done, but right now, no. My concern is that in general, bodies defend weight loss, and so
I feel as though.
So I always say, you know, whatever you're doing from a weight control, weight loss point of view does need to be for life. And I'll just give you an example that I often tell my patients is I also work with, you know, bariatric surgeons. And part of my role there is to help patients who are experiencing weight regain after bariatric surgery. And I'll just give you an example of the sleeve gastrectomy where the surgeons remove two-thirds of the stomach and they're experiencing weight gain 5 years later. It's not because their stomach has regrown, right? Their body's physiology has adapted, and we have this theory called set point theory, and the body is very good at trying to return to that set point. You know, the body looks at weight loss as though it is, you know, a threat to survival, and I'm amazed at how much the body will respond to weight loss. It lowers our metabolic rate, increases our hungry hormones, but so it needs to be something that for people who have clinical obesity, very long-term management.
And body, your body is not your friend all the time.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, I find the other thing too is that people say, oh, I'll take the Wegovy and I'll lose weight. You have to use it in conjunction with the diet and exercise.
Absolutely.
And we have a little mini support group. And that's what we discovered was unless you're going to look at your diet and look at doing some exercise, increasing your exercise or starting exercise, it just didn't work.
Mm.
So that's how we've got a, you know, we've recognised is that, a, you know, to having to look at the other lifestyle factors as well rather than just think that the Wegovy is going to be a magic cure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Mary. 1-300-800-222. This is not to say, is it, Terry Lynn, that diet and exercise is not the gold standard for weight loss? It is, isn't it?
Correct. It is.
I mean, we're not going away from this. I mean, it 100% is. If you eat less in a smart way, and get exercise, then that's the gold standard for losing weight. Now, understand, for a lot of people who are living with obesity, that doesn't work for them, and it doesn't work for complex reasons, does it?
That's absolutely correct. Obesity is a very complex system. And when we're talking about these, you know, drug research trials, it was always on a basis of lifestyle intervention in regards to eating as well as exercise and what we call behaviour change. But 100%, you know, lifestyle is so important.
Yeah.
And the drugs are an add-on.
Yeah. I mean, as we've discussed many times with Dr. Luigi Fontana, who comes on the program fairly regularly here tonight, you know, a combination of looking after yourself, getting proper sleep, getting proper exercise, and basically basing your diet around the so-called Mediterranean diet principles is the way forward for healthy weight maintenance and general good health anyway.
That's exactly right.
You would agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so those are, you know, what we call the pillars of lifestyle medicine.
Mm.
And even if someone, you know, did all of those things and they didn't lose weight, they're gaining health, and that's been proven. So
yeah,
I do
yeah.
support, you know, a weight-neutral approach to health and obesity management as well. So,
Margaret from Sandringham says, I'm on Wegovy, currently 2.4 milligrams. Can I continue taking this if I fall pregnant?
No.
No.
And I would be advising that she should be on some very reliable contraceptive. And that was another thing that the TGA came out with, that concern about potential risk in suicidal ideation. They also did mention specifically in regards to Mounjaro, not Wegovy, about the concern of lessening the effectiveness of oral contraceptive pill.
Okay. A lot of people talk about coming off the recommended dosage then to start microdosing to maintain weight loss. Does this work?
We've got no evidence to say that that does work. But I also think that it depends on what you're taking the medication for. So, for example, if you're taking the Wegovy 2.4 for cardiovascular risk reduction, there is no evidence to say that a lower dose will have that cardiovascular risk reduction. We've only got the evidence of the 2.4 dose. So all I can say is we don't have evidence for that.
When you say that it improves your cardiovascular health, in what way? Does it reduce deposits inside blood vessels, or does it improve the health of the heart muscle? What does it do?
A number of different things. So it reduces all of those what we'd call risk factors for cardiovascular disease. So it reduces blood pressure, it reduces the total cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol, which is that atherogenic cholesterol.
Right.
It reduces the triglycerides, which is another blood fat that contributes to the increased plaques in the heart. But it can also help with regards to the heart muscle. So we have seen some research that shows shows that this medication is very helpful in heart failure as well.
Dear, oh dear, oh dear, it is a wonder drug, isn't it? I mean, I know clinically that expression doesn't mean is meaningless and probably unhelpful, but gee, it does sound like that in lots of ways. And no, I do not work for the drug company. Helen in Launceston, hello. Hi, Helen.
Oh, hello. I'm diabetic. I've been on insulin, mm-hmm. and the doctor decided to put me on Ozempic to kind of see if we could reduce the amount of insulin and also improve control of my diabetes. Unfortunately, I had a severe allergic reaction to Ozempic. It was terrible. The gastric complications. I ended up almost unable to eat, vomiting, severe pain, and then developed gastroparesis and had to be treated for that, which was very unpleasant. And I'm not allowed to take it anymore. And I had no idea that would happen with taking it. And in fact, it's affected my health. And I'm sorry I ever started taking it.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, Terry Lynn, it doesn't work for everyone, does it?
Yeah, I'm very sorry to hear of that terrible experience, Helen. But you're right, it doesn't work for everybody. But we also know that there will be some people who have certain past medical history background that will be at increased risk for gastroparesis, as one example. And type 2 diabetes is one of those risk factors that would increase an individual. So we do need to understand that the person in front of me that I'm prescribing for, I'm trying to assess all of their, what we'd call, you know, pre-medication risks of developing certain known side effects, and gastroparesis is a known side effect.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Okay, Helen. Okay. Sorry to hear it, but I mean, it doesn't work for everyone. That is true. What do you say to the criticism that these drugs are, you know, quick fixes rather than real solutions? That we ought to be, you know, not lessening our focus on health, nutrition, eating properly, and exercising more.
I would agree that we shouldn't lessen our focus on health, nutrition, exercising more, all of those sorts of things. Mm. And I disagree that it's a quick fix, because I'm saying that people need to be on this medication, you know, long term. And so, you know, I agree and disagree. It's not a quick fix. It is a long-term add-on medication for a chronic complex condition. And I like to try and challenge people's views around obesity being a chronic condition. If we compare it to, say, someone who gets blood pressure, you know, in middle of life, they come in to see their GP. Oh, while you're here, can I just take your blood pressure? Oh, yes, doctor. So I do that, and the number's a little bit high. I go, oh, it's a bit high. And then the patient's saying, oh, I feel fine. And, you know, imagine the doctor putting the finger at you, going, oh, no, you've got to do something about this. This high blood pressure, it can cause you a stroke, a heart attack, a kidney disease, etc. And the patient goes away, and, you know, we might actually repeat those measurements to make sure it's true. We might try, depending on how severe that high blood pressure is, you know, lifestyle intervention first. So reduce stress, sleep better, low sodium diet, exercise more, all of those sorts of things from a lifestyle point of view. That patient comes back, and I'm not blaming them for not working hard enough that lifestyle intervention didn't work. I'll say, great, I'm glad you tried that, but your blood pressure is still high, still at risk. Let's do the next step in management, which is to add medication. And if the first medication at low dose doesn't work, you know, we titrate that up. In fact, sometimes we might start two medications at once. And again, if that medication or combination of interventions don't work, I'm not blaming that person as an individual to say you didn't try hard enough. And if the medication does work and we do get to what we call treatment target with regards to blood pressure, I'm not saying to them, congratulations, you got to your target, to your goal, you can stop that medication now. Because if they did, we would expect their blood pressure to go back up.
All right. Sean from Appen. G'day, Sean.
Hey, mate, how you going?
Yeah, good.
I had an experience with weight loss from my local GP many years ago, and he prescribed me to a thing called Duramine. Now, I took it for a while. It was working, but because of my profession as a truck driver, I found I couldn't take it because it registered on a...
A drug test thing, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I mean, I've tried the Manjaro and stuff like that, but it's just become far too expensive to sort of keep it up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is a problem, isn't it, Terry Lynn?
It is.
This is the equity argument that you're raising, and it's a fair one.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Very expensive. And the people who need the medication the most are the ones who can least afford it. There certainly is an increase, what we call prevalence of obesity for rural and remote areas of Australia, as well as what we call lower socioeconomic demographic as well.
Sean, I think a lot of people would agree with you. That's, $300 a month, it's out of reach for a lot of people.
Yeah, it is. It's ridiculous. And it sort of seems that, the higher the dose, the more it sort of goes up.
That's true, isn't it, Terry Lynn? The higher the dose, the more expensive it is. I mean, that's just straight gouging, isn't it, by the drug company, I presume?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, it starts at three, and then it went up to 500, and then the last script I got off my doctor, it was up over 700, and I'm really? Looking at him like, I can't afford that.
No.
There's no way.
Yeah, fair enough. Good point, Sean. Thanks, mate. Good luck with it.
Thank you, mate.
This is the point you're making. It ought to be on the PBS at a reasonable rate, Terry Lynn.
Yeah, like I think so. I think that the PBS needs to weigh up the health improvements with the cost of the drug. I'm sure there can be some sort of meeting where the pharmaceutical company can potentially lower the cost of the drug, but also the PBS looking at not just in regards to immediate cost savings and health improvements, but what we call ripple effects. So, the person living with severe obesity, it's not just their health, it's that they, if it's particularly severe, it will be affecting their ability to work and actually, contribute to taxes, but also they might need a carer, therefore that carer is being pulled out, of their, their work and their contribution to the community as well.
My texter says, "Hi, what happens when you reach your desired weight? Do you keep taking the medication? How does the body know when to stop losing weight so you don't become underweight?" There's evidence that it stops working at a certain point, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. So there will always be a plateau. Sometimes what that plateau number is, that might be higher than what someone has in their own head as desirable, or it might actually be lower. And certainly with regards to the diabetes trials, people did need to stop the medication. So that it was being used for blood glucose control. They may not needed to have lost weight. And because they started on the medication and lost weight, they needed to stop, absolutely. Mm. So yeah, it is very much about, what are people actually trying to achieve here with regards to their health goals.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Len in Melbourne. Hi, Len.
Oh, hi. I was going to say it's been so informative tonight, so thank you for everything that's been discussed. It makes so much sense. My GP was reluctant to, but I have been on it long term, so I asked my GP for a referral to an endocrinologist, and the endocrinologist asked me, and prescribed it. So now the GP is supportive of that. But I did go down that path. And I feel, just in that last discussion about plateauing a bit, that I have been on it long term now for about 4 years, and it is very effective for blood glucose, maintaining those levels and the other vitals. But weight loss has certainly more or less plateaued. And I've had some discussion with the endocrinologist that I'm seeing about, possibly increasing beyond the 1 mil dose weekly. So, but I haven't at this point. I've just maintained that same level.
Okay.
So it's between the GP and, as I said, I still see an endocrinologist who is, very expensive to see, but I just sort of feel that's giving that higher level support for potential issues that may arise.
Yeah. Fair enough. Thanks, Lynn. Terry Lynn, a text question. I've heard about contraceptives, says Doug from Bundoora. I've heard about contraceptives. What about the take-up of antiretrovirals like PrEP? I mean, are there any risks of it not providing cover against HIV given the slower stomach function?
That's a very good question. And so there have been what we call pharmacokinetic studies. And as from apart from the oral contraceptive pill, there are no other TGA warnings. But it is a good thing to understand that I have had other patients who are on medications which they have what we call a narrow therapeutic index. Mm-hmm. An example might be anti-epileptic medication, where the amount that's actually travelling around in the blood is really important to control seizures. And it's a theoretical risk with regards to delayed gastric emptying, but apart from the oral contraceptive pill and Mounjaro, there are no other, at the moment, concerns or TGA recommendations. But in theory, yes, there is some concerns. We have not seen it in a practical sense, and we've not actually seen it in a practical sense with regards to the oral contraceptive pill. So again, it's still a theoretical concern. But yeah, Doug's on the money, but there's no evidence to be particularly concerned with regards to PrEP.
There's anecdotal evidence I've heard too that it may stop you preferring alcohol and may diminish your taste for alcohol. There's some suggestion that it might also affect other life pleasures. People feel less enthusiastic about pleasurable pursuits. I don't know. Is there any evidence about that?
I don't believe so. Certainly.
I mean, do you feel less interested in sex, for example? I mean, I'm just thinking of what it might affect.
Yeah, look, I think I have heard that myself, but I also have seen the evidence where these medications can actually increase testosterone in men. Mm. And so if we are actually talking about libido, again, that's extremely complex. There's a mental health component, there's a physical component. But I do think that, yes, there can be some people who are very vulnerable from a worsening mental health because of the loss of pleasure that food and alcohol and potentially the socialising that goes around that is reduced. So I think it's complex. Is it the drug or is it the things that go with the enjoyment of food, alcohol and socialising?
Mm. Rachel's from Nambour. Sorry, Rachel, you've been waiting on there. Hello.
G'day, how's it going?
Yeah, good.
Yeah, my perspective is a little bit unique. I was on one of the clinical studies at a hospital in Brisbane for what was fun to me is the next replacement for Trulicity, for Ozempic, rather.
Mm.
Obviously, I didn't know the brand name because it was a double-blind study. And now I ended up having to go off the drug for the study because I did have a rather negative mental health episode, but there was other stuff happening in my life as well. But they thought rather than just in case, you know, they thought the safest option was to do that. But the point they made is this, is that they still wanted my data, even though I was off the clinical, the study drug, because it then allowed them to establish a baseline. And the other thing that occurred to me is when I finished with the trial, I went back on to the semaglutides. And I haven't been having the same issues with that. So I guess it's a very long-winded way of saying while there might be side effects, that there is a side effect isn't a reason to not do it. It's to investigate it and see what your clinical staff have had to say.
Yeah, okay. Terry Lynn, what do you make of that?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think that it's very much an individual assessment of potential, you know, pros, cons, risks, and that some people may have things in their past medical history that makes some of those risk factors more likely.
Okay. My texter says, would I need to terminate a pregnancy if I was taking Wegovy?
The answer to that is no. Don't recommend people fall pregnant on the medication. Mm. We recommend, you know, effective contraceptive and looking at if people are taking oral contraceptive with Mounjaro, they also use a second line barrier. But as soon as someone found out they were pregnant, stop it straight away. But no, there is no seen severe, what we call teratogenic effects seen in humans. So there has been, retrospective studies of, quote unquote, Ozempic babies. And the results of that have not been any worse this far. Yeah.
All right. Good news. Terry Lynn, time has beaten us. It's flown past, I know. But thank you. It's been most interesting and informative, and I do thank you. Dr. Terry Lynn South is GP and Chair of the Royal Australian College of GPs Group on Obesity Management. Thanks, Terry Lynn.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.